vision. What was Carl Gustav Jung doing? So Jung used these words, vision, imagination, and sometimes fantasy, to describe his experiences. And here again, note, these are not concepts. They're not theories. They are words used by Jung to point at an experience, something that happened to him. What was it? What was that experience? I assume we can all accept that people have visual hallucinations. I assure you, if you take methamphetamine or cocaine intravenously for about 2 weeks, you will reach a state of mental and physical collapse in which you can't take methamphetamine or cocaine intravenously any longer. And you will have visions. I would call them hallucinations. You will see the demons of hell crawling through the floor. You will see maggots eating your flesh. I have had people come in who have actually ripped the skin off their arms trying to get at the bugs they saw consuming them during this type of hallucinosis. But that's an hallucinosis. Hallucination, it means, etymologically, it means a wandering of the mind. One hell of a wandering. But that's not what I'm talking about. The word vision, etymologically, in its history, has been used to describe seeing things, but not necessarily a wandering. Seeing things that are somehow meaningful. The word's been associated for millennia in the tradition of our Romance languages with mystical experience, actually. Not hallucination, vision. So, do people have visions? I offer you Exhibit 1, the comment that was just made. I know, based on experience, that sometimes people have vivid visualizations. Not just wanderings, but things that come to them in an orderly and meaningful fashion. Now, this does sometimes happen under situations of extreme physiological stress, what we might say a disordered state of our neurotransmitters, of our brain chemistry. ICU patients in intensive care units who are critically ill, will sometimes have visions. They will sometimes have disordered hallucinations too, but sometimes they have events happen to them which they sense as entirely real and as meaningful. Comforting even. Even ecstatic. I suppose Dick Cheney would be my example of the least mystically inclined individual that I might choose from the stage of public affairs, okay? But I recently read a review of his biography in which he told about a vision that he had. I mean, he was blessed with a terrible heart. And near death, during his recent operations, he in his biography, he tells about a vision of being in a beautiful field. And he said it was completely real. And it was meaningful to him. Jung himself, in 1944, nearly died. He broke his ankle, got a blood clot in his leg. 12 days later, he had a pulmonary embolus in February of 1944, and he nearly died. There was no treatment at that time, really, for a pulmonary embolism. He had a heart attack. And for 3 weeks, he really floated between life and death. During that period, he had a series of visions, which he considered entirely real. He describes them as amongst the most meaningful and beautiful events of his life. And here I give you another clinical example. I work as a doctor. Over the years, I've had patients come in, often in advanced age, and the daughter or the companion bringing the patient in will pull me aside and tell me. There, amplify myself. Will pull me aside and tell me, "Mom's seeing things." Is this my experience alone? Have you heard this? And so I'll go in and I'll sit down and talk to this woman who is not in extremis, who's not demented, who's not even particularly ill, except for being too old. And sometimes they will tell me about these experiences. Yeah, and you know who they've seen? Who?
Relatives.
Yeah. Ancestors. Relatives. A dead father. A dead husband. A dead dear one. A child. And if you open your ear, if you sit there and they understand that you're somebody that they can talk to, they'll tell you more. And you know what? The events are not frightening to these people. They're comforting. They know that it is an experience that is preparing them for a passage. This happened, and my mother told me about it, to my mother in the month before she died. It happened to my aunt, who was about the most grounded, practical person I know. No mystical inclinations that I ever noted, and I knew her very, very well. And you know who she was visited by? My father, who had died many, many years before. She told me about that experience with complete sincerity. A vision. Was it a hallucination? Oh, it was specific, it was direct, it was meaningful, and it helped her greatly in a difficult passage. There's this concept of the vision quest. We've heard that over the new agey discussions of recent times. I had something like that happen to me once. I was in my younger years interested in mountain climbing. It was my own therapy at the time, my own craziness. And I was climbing a very high mountain, K2, and I was about. Yeah, K2. The North Ridge of K2, 1986. And I was climbing alone, really high on the mountain. I was entirely by myself. It was about 25,000 feet. Now, let me tell you that when you're doing that, you're not thinking mystical thoughts. You're thinking about staying alive. In fact, you have no time to do anything but think about staying alive, or you don't. Okay? And I was climbing along, and I got to this place on the mountain. And you can't tell. This is private, okay. I got to this place on the mountain. No, you're going to tell, are you? Okay. And I suddenly got to a place where I was high enough that I could see above all the other peaks in the Karakoram Range surrounding. And the mountain, I mean, this is a big mountain. And when you're standing at the bottom of it, it's just big. But I got to a place where I could see the summit. It was right there, visually. And the mountain is a perfect cone at the top. It cones down. And I got to this place where the cone of the mountain, the summit and the cone, was entirely within my visual perspective. I could reach out and put my arms around it. And I was standing there, and I realized that, and I looked at it, and I was wham. I was overcome with something so intense and incredible that I really can't explain it. But it came as a series of visions, visual. They were kaleidoscopic, but they had meaning. And it was really one of the most beautiful and emotional experiences of my life. It was a complete cleansing, a complete tearing away of a past and an opening of a future. I have no idea how long the experience lasted. I was on a very steep ice slope. I remember putting my head down on the ice, and tears were rolling down my face, and I was holding on, and it went on. I don't know. It could have been 5 minutes. It could have been 10 minutes. It could have been 40 minutes. But I do know that I was aware of the fact that I had to make it stop because I had a long ways to go to the place where I could camp, to the place where I was planning on camping at 26,000 feet about. And I finally just shook my head and I looked around and looked up and I got to get going. And I went on. I was completely in control of my senses throughout the experience and after. It was a life-changing experience. I really knew that my life was changing that moment in those visions, that I'd seen something of a past and of a future that I can't really explain further. I got up to my camp and I told a friend there that he had been waiting. He'd gone the day before. He'd been my tent mate for 3 months. And I told him, Steve, I just had this incredible experience. And that's all I could say. And I remember Steve looking at me and said, strange things happen to people in the mountains, don't they? Okay. This same man came to visit me 4 years later to stay with me for a few days. And he had just finished a solo ascent of the north face of Mount Everest, a speed ascent entirely by himself, a three-day speed ascent. He had made it to the summit in 2 days. And the man's an incredible mountaineer, an athlete, obviously. This is really pushing things to the brink of human endurance. But he did it. He made it to the summit and back off the summit down to about 26,000 feet, off the summit pyramid. And he had been climbing for over 36 hours straight at a level of, I cannot imagine it. I mean, and I've tried. I've been there. I cannot imagine what he did, but he did it. He got back to this camp, and it was already dark. He was exhausted, as you might understand. He was also deeply dehydrated, which, you know, you can only carry so much water when you're up that high because it freezes. The only way you keep it from freezing is just put it in your pockets inside your coat. And after a while, it's gone. You can't eat snow and hydrate. It cools too much. You can't do it. It doesn't work. So he got back to the camp, and the one thing he had to do is he had to hydrate himself to survive. This was life on the line. So you have this little butane stove there, and where do you get your water? You get it from snow outside the tent into the pot. You put a lot of snow in a pot, you end up with that much water. You've got to keep doing it, and water boils at about 110 degrees at that altitude, 115 degrees. You know, it's not very hot. And he was sitting there trying to fill his pot, and he was falling asleep. And he knew if he slept, he'd die. He'd die. And he came to visit me, and he wanted to tell me about an experience. I never told him what happened to me, other than that one comment. He wanted to tell me about an experience that happened to him. And this is the experience, okay? He had fallen asleep, and suddenly he felt a hand on his shoulder awaken him. And he awakened, and he understood that there was an Oriental woman behind him. She said she was not Tibetan, and she was not Nepalese, she was not Indian. He says she was Oriental, but he couldn't really define. He said maybe perhaps more Japanese. And she was an older woman, but not extremely elderly. And she said, Steve, wake up. Put water in the pot, drink. And every time he started to fall asleep, she would be there. He said she was behind me, but I could see her. I knew she was sitting right behind me, and her arm was on my shoulder, and she kept waking me up to drink all night long. And he says, if she had not done that, if she hadn't been there, I realized what she was doing and I gave myself over to her care. And she kept me awake. She kept me drinking. He wasn't able to sleep. 36 hours, he wasn't able to sleep. He had to stay up drinking. When dawn came, he says, as the light started to come and he was ready to finish his descent, get all the way off the Stam Mountain, he says, as she disappeared, and a second figure appeared. He said, and this fellow really was like a Sherpa. And, you know, when you're wearing mountaineering equipment up there high, there are all these layers. And you have to take some of them off when you get in a tent, and you have to put a lot of them, all of them, back on when you get out. And there's an order. It's really, it's like putting on armor, I guess, of an old medieval knight. And you got to put things on in the right order. And you can really be befuddled. It can be hard. You can actually get your boots on before you put the thing on that was supposed to go on before your boots. Then you have to take your boots off again. At 26,000 feet, that's a lot of energy. And the Sherpa came, and, you know, it was like, Sahib, time to go. And he instructed him about everything he was supposed to do. He says, now do this like a guide. He guided him through getting ready. And when Steve was ready to leave the tent, he bowed and waved goodbye. Then on the way down, he I probably shouldn't be using his name, but then on the way down, he says a third figure came. This third figure was sort of accompanying him all the way down the mountain. But he said, as I became closer and closer to safety, as I got closer down the mountain, he became more and more and more distant and invisible, and finally was gone. And he said, that figure, I mean, the other two, he said, yeah, I have precise memories of them, but this last one, he said, it faded as I got down. And you know what he asked me? What happened to me? This guy was a civil engineer. He's, you know, down to earth as they get. Not a mystical bone in his body that I noted, other than he loved climbing mountains, which I guess is a type of mysticism. And he was good at it, too. Incredibly good at it. Well, and he told me, he said, you know, he told other people about this, and he'd always ask the same question. What happened? What was this? And he told me that the answers he'd received. He said, somebody told me it was my anima, an animus. Somebody else told me it was my guardian angel. Someone else told me that I simply turned off outside consciousness and my instincts had kicked in and personified themselves, whatever that means. So he asked me what my answer was. And I thought about it, and my answer is, it doesn't matter what anyone said. None of those names matter. None of them. The point is, you had the experience that rests behind any such names.
That what did you say?
You had the experience that rests behind, under any such name. Call it a guardian angel. Call it an anima. Those are concepts. Those are words. What did you have? You had the guts, the valorization of word, the experience that is the beginning of our descriptive vocabulary of spiritual, of psychological, of physical reality. Is that making sense? Any sense? And that is not a hallucination in my book. Those are not hallucinations. You know, sometimes these things, they can happen without physiological stress. I mean, Steve's circumstance was extraordinary. What happened to me, I didn't feel that stressed out. I mean, I was tired and it was hard, but I didn't feel at the end of my abilities for sure. I've had a small number of people over the years tell me about vivid visionary experiences happening under conditions of completely normal health, physiology. In most instances, people are a bit hesitant to talk about these things. And in most cases, they puzzle about them themselves. I'm not suggesting this is a common experience. As best I can discern, it doesn't happen to many people. But it does happen. It is. In some instances, this sort of experience can take on actually rather transcendental or sacred qualities. And in that sense, they become increasingly guarded. They really are sacred. They're not things we talk about much. I knew a woman who had some intense experiences like this, visionary experiences, which had a religious, to her, sense. They didn't fit into any category of dogma, but they were real, and they happened to her. Extreme visual experiences that were orderly and meaningful, that she journaled in her early years, not knowing what the hell had happened to her, but she wrote it down. In midlife, she went to see Testing! You awake? Okay. Just wanted to check. I thought it was a sort of a strange poltergeist effect. Okay, all right. So, in midlife, she went to see a fairly famous psychiatrist with some help with daily life, actually. She saw this same psychiatrist on a regular basis for 15 years. And I knew her pretty well, and I asked her what he had to say about the visions that she told me about, very privately. And she said, I never told him about them. He wouldn't understand. As best I can tell, that wasn't what he does. But he does refill my prescriptions, which I take, you know, which she took to take care of the insanity of daily life. All right? You know, these things can be pretty darn private. And, you know, that sounded like an extremely sane approach. There are things we don't talk about. Or more sadly, there are things we do not even consider carefully. Because accepted theories of human experience exclude them as empirical facts of normal life. They are crazy. They're taboo. Taboo. We don't want to go there. Jung did not show the Red Book to many people in his life. It waited almost a century for disclosure. Jung rarely talked about the visions he had experienced and recorded in Liber Novus. He gave only that one seminar in 1925 describing some of this material at a time when it was still very recent. In his life, he really told very few people about what had happened to him. When he drew some of the specific visionary and imaginative events into his later writing, into his didactic material, and he used them for didactic reasons usually, he almost always described them as dreams. And often he related them and commented upon them without noting that they were his visions. You know, the publication, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, in 1961, after his death, gave the first detailed glimpse into this inner life of Jung that really anyone had. It took 50 more years after his death before the primary record, Liber Novus, became available to us. And only now can we begin to piece his story and his history together. In 1916, toward the end of the visionary record, which appears in Liber Novus, Jung attempted to write a scientifically toned psychological essay about what he had been doing. He titled it The Transcendent Function, and after he had worked on it and finished his draft, he decided he couldn't publish it. He wouldn't publish it. And so it sat in his files. Around 1953, students at the Jung Institute found this in his private files that he had allowed them to look through and wanted to publish it. Jung felt that it was a very provisional attempt, that it was incomplete, perhaps inadequate, but that it was part of the record. And he allowed them to publish it. But he wrote an introduction for the published version. And this essay now appears in his collected works. It's in volume 8, I believe. In fact, I know. And in his introduction to this essay, he says this: "As its basic argument is still valid today, speaking of this essay, it may stimulate the reader to a broader and deeper understanding of the problem. This problem is identical with the universal question. How does one come to terms in practice with the unconscious? This is the question posed by the philosophy of India, and particularly by Buddhism and Zen, indirectly. It is a fundamental question in practice of all religions and all philosophies. For the unconscious is not this thing or that. It is the unknown, with capital letter, the unknown, as it immediately affects us. The unknown, as it immediately affects us. The method of active imagination herein described is the most important auxiliary for production of those contents of the unconscious which lie, as it were, immediately below the threshold of consciousness, and when intensified are the most likely to erupt spontaneously into the conscious mind. The method, therefore, is not without its dangers and should, if possible, not be employed except under expert supervision." In his introduction, he then lists the three dangers of this technique. And here he's calling it active imagination. Now, if you've read much about Jung stuff, you've come across this term as a process of coming into deeper contact with the unconscious. I have done this. It does sometimes work, amazingly. But there are three dangers, okay? So Jung says the lesser danger, nothing will happen. Dig. Did I start? The dishwasher. Dig. Is that the cat at the door? Dig. You know, we can't get there. And it will lead to no positive results. We'll get stuck in a circle of free associations. This thing leads to that thing leads to that. You know, very much in our conscious realm of activity. It's the first danger, and you know what? It's the place where most people hit a wall. Okay, the second danger, still relatively harmless, Jung says, is we will evoke authentic contents, real visions, but we will take an exclusively aesthetic interest in them, or remain stuck in an all-enveloping phantasmagoria, like going to the movies. Like, oh, I don't know. It's an LSD trip where it's just for fun. No ethical, well, they are sometimes, you know, where there's no ethical commitment to what arises. Or there's another thing that I find very common in our society. Somebody has a really interesting fantasy come to them, maybe spontaneously or mainly even through an attempt at an evocative procedure. What's the first thought? This will make a great movie. I think I've got the first chapter of that best-selling book. We try to monetize it. We take it from the depths, throw it into this time. and try to find in it use and value. Take the nonsense and make some sense and dollars. Okay. That's the third danger. Or the second danger. The third danger is real and very serious. And I do mean real. And I do mean, and so did Jung, very serious. Divisions may overpower the conscious mind and take possession of the personality, leading to a genuine psychotic interval. A genuine psychotic interval. I've witnessed this happening, not to somebody I was working with and I know well. And trying to pull people back from that, they can really become almost manic in the fact that visual material is coming. And they can fall into complete psychosis. They can lose contact. That is a real danger. And that's why Jung says expert supervision. Well, let me add, I don't know many experts in this technique, so I don't know where you're going to find that expert supervision. But as Dr. Shyam Dasami points out in his editorial notes to Liber Novus, this 1916 essay is one key to understanding Jung's experience. It is his first attempt at a psychological commentary upon what he was doing. Jung begins this essay, and I'm going to abbreviate somewhat because there's other stuff I want to get to. He begins this essay by saying, there is nothing mysterious or metaphysical about the term transcendent function. The psychological transcendent function arises from the union of conscious and unconscious contents. Conscious and unconscious. Outer and inner. It's a bridge. The function is a bridge. It's an attitude that allows us to stand between our awareness, conscious awareness, awake awareness, feet on the ground, hands holding on to something, and being conscious and direct experience of the inner. That's a pretty extraordinary thought, isn't it? Doesn't happen very often. Okay. So he talks about the ways we get there. What is the royal road to the unconscious? Did I hear dreams said a few times? Were you thinking that? Even if you didn't say it, you can. You can say it. It's okay. Dreams! The royal road to the unconscious. And you know what Jung said? No! Not dreams. They aren't the royal road. Jung says in this essay, this is pretty amazing when you look at everything that goes on in analytic practice, things that call themselves Jungian therapy today. Jung says that dream is not adequate to the transcendent function. And I quote, "We must now make clear what is required to produce the transcendent function. First and foremost, we need the unconscious material. We need to come in contact, conscious with unconscious. The most readily accessible expression of unconscious processes is undoubtedly the dream. The dream is, so to speak, a pure product of unconsciousness. But, he continues, since the energy tension in sleep is usually very low, dreams, compared with conscious material, are inferior expressions of unconscious contents and are very difficult to understand. Has that been your experience? A bit difficult to understand? That's my experience.
Could you repeat what he
He says that the energy tension in sleep is usually very low. And by energy tension, I think he means conscious awareness of what's happening. You know, we're behind several, you know, you look, when you wake up, it's like veil after veil falls. Even when you are on the threshold of the dream, and you know it's important, and you're sitting there, and you know that as you rise up out of that dream, you want to hold on to this, the details. I mean, you feel this, you know, and you're sitting there trying to drag the thing back with you into consciousness. And the next thing you know, it's like, you can't get to the detail. But you know that there were very specific details, right? I think this is a common experience. So he says the energy tension in sleep is very low. In general, dreams are unsuitable or difficult to make use of in developing the transcendent function because they make two great demands on the subject. We can't pull them back up. That demand of to bring them back up is really beyond a common ability. Then he talks about spontaneous fantasies. And people do have spontaneous fantasies. Things just occur to us. All of a sudden we find ourselves in a story. We may not pay attention to it very often, but of course once we start trying, we may find these things happen frequently. And we can use those as an entry, as a way to begin. But some people don't have those. And then he goes on to this third function, which he calls the transcendent function. And this is what he's talking about. This is that thing I'm talking to you about, the focused visionary opening. This is what he was doing with the digging at the very beginning. Well, remember, this is at the beginning of the Red Book. This is when he's trying to find entry, trying to get past that barren desert, trying to penetrate more deeply. Immediately after this thing happened, at the beginning of December, the door just blew open. He didn't need to use that sort of focused intention quite so much. Once he found that doorway, once he passed through the threshold, it was like, whoa, that's what you're going to meet in the Red Book. Okay? But he's trying to describe what's happened to him. This is 1916. It's right in the middle of this material. And here's what he says. He says, critical attention must be eliminated. Visual types should concentrate on the expectation that an inner image will be produced. As a rule, such a fantasy picture will appear, perhaps hypnagogically, and should be carefully observed and noted down in writing. Hypnagogic. That word means on the road to sleep. Not in sleep, not in awakeness, in that experiential circumstance that you experience in front of the fire after the turkey on Thanksgiving, where your head starts nodding and all of a sudden some very pleasant images start appearing. Okay. Now, of course, there are some people who aren't so visual. And Jung goes on in the essay to say some people are more auditory types or visual auditory. And they may find that as things come, they don't come so intensely as visions, but they can write them down. They can write the fantasy down and enter into it. And my experience with this is that as you're writing, the vision is, I mean, it's not so intensely visual, but it's very visual. And what happens, I mean, what you're doing is you're observing and recording. And maybe in the creative effort of writing a fiction work, this is something people are getting to. You know, you're discovering who your people, who your characters, who your scenes, what your scenes are. Right? Other people are more tactile. Have any of you experienced with sand play? Okay. Sand play. Tactile. Some people are more tactile. You know, some people don't like that, don't want to do it, and don't find it useful. Other people find that really helps. Well, Jung was talking about this stuff in 1916. You know, the sand play stuff, a lot of it came out of just these sorts of considerations. Other people are more plastic. There are people who like to work with clay. Some of you may know the name of Gilda Frans, who really one of the wonderful elders of Jungian psychology down in Los Angeles, who I dearly respect. Gilda started doing this stuff, the molding. Her husband was an analyst, and she was in this analytic community in Los Angeles. And I heard her telling about how she got into her own practice. And it really began because she had this ability with plastic arts, and other analysts started referring people to her to try to work things out with that medium. Well, this is a bit removed from the deep entry that Jung's talking about visually, but it all is part of that same general sense of experience. But, and here's the big but. Before anything is going to erupt from the unconscious, there has to be some tension. There has to be a need. There has to be a power seeking expression from inside of ourselves. If we're completely content with life, having generally good luck, feeling mostly happy. Are there any of those people? But, well, if there are, they're probably not looking to take a vision journey, and right? The tension level's not so high. So Jung said, you know, what causes us? What brings people to that threshold where something needs to happen? And what he says is that there has to be some tension. Now, he lists two things that he considers are common. Let's see if I can find where I wrote that down. Yeah. There are two things. Generally, he says it's depression or a general sense of discontent. A general sense of discontent. Now, I would say that it's more than a little depression and a more than a little discontent. If you read what was happening to Jung that I read earlier, where he said unbearable longing, resolve a situation. I would say really to cross this threshold, unbearable longing, intense sense of the bridge that needs to be built is going to be present. That doesn't happen to many of us. And when it does happen to most of us, we don't find the bridge. In a way, that's what Jungian psychology, Jungian therapy is about, helping us find the bridge. It can start with dreams, or synchronicities, or fantasies, and in some cases, it can be enhanced with actual visionary experience through the technique of active imagination. But that is an extraordinarily difficult path, and not many people are very good at it. He finishes his essay saying, "The shuttling to and fro of arguments and affects represents the transcendent function of opposites, the bridging function of opposites, I would add, the confrontation of two positions." The confrontation of two positions creates a living third thing. The confrontation of two positions. What are those two positions? Inner, outer, conscious connection with the world, and the unconscious inner infinity. Confrontation of two positions creates a living third thing, a movement out of the suspension between the opposites, a living birth that leads to a new level of being, a new situation. The transcendent function manifests itself as a quality of conjoined opposites. Two positions. Two worlds. A bridge. A crossroads. A royal crossroads. Where inner and outer realities touch. A place of Hermes. And it can be a place of intense eros. Eros. This next section of the subject I was going to cover tonight is called Real Women, Jung in Love. There are both personal and archetypal depths probed by Jung in Liber Novus. Jung came to his confrontation with the unconscious in 1913, after at least 13 years struggling to understand the nature of psychic phenomena. This struggle of understanding was not just that of a clinical observer, a physician in encounter with a patient, or a collection of patients and their family and personal clinical histories. Jung was involved in a struggle to understand himself, his own family history, his own dreams and imaginings and loves, the many parts of his own self-observation. He came to his science with a self-interest. He had sensed a wound. He knew it in himself. And he saw its rending pains projected into his world. He came to the wound as a physician. And he knew he must meet it and understand it. What he came to realize was that the wound was a rending in modern consciousness. Humankind of this time had lost all vital relationship with the inner fact of an infinite interior realm of experience. Women and men live in two worlds, but we had forgotten that fact, denied it, made it taboo. We've looked a bit at Jung's technique of meeting the unconscious through imaginative vision. And I said this thing about there has to be some tension or energy between the opposites in the relation of conscious and unconscious for imaginative material to emerge. The polarity between the inner and outer must be bridged, but there must be arousal of a libido. What Jung would have called a psychic energy. That word is general. It's not just sexual. Psychic energy. But, you know one thing, one type of arousal that can blow the doors of the psyche open? Love. Love. Eros is such a force. It might even be the indicator, the symptom of the energy working at us to bridge opposites. In the creation of Liber Novus, the eros of relationship is between two infinite realities, between inner infinite and outer infinite. We live in two worlds. Jung found himself at the crossroads, where a transcendental imaginative function allowed two things to touch and create the new. And when that happens, love is in the air. So let's talk about Dr. Jung in love. In 1993, John Kerr published a remarkable book titled A Most Dangerous Method, the story of Jung, Freud, and Sabina Spielrein.
I'm sorry.
The story of Jung, Freud, and Sabina Spielrein. S-P-I-E-L-R-I-E-N. The book was a development of Kerr's dissertation for his PhD degree at New York University. Subsequently, in 2002, Christopher Hampton used the book as the basis for a relatively successful play called The Talking Method. And in the summer of 2011, a major film titled A Most Dangerous Method, based closely on the book, premiered at several film festivals. A general release is scheduled on November 22nd in Los Angeles and New York, and sometimes soon coming to a theater near you, unless you live in a backwater like Salt Lake City, in which case it may be next year. The book, which was published almost two decades ago, and now in a broader current cultural awareness, this film raised several issues that demand some comment and some understanding. The book provided a sensitive, reasonably balanced, and accurate portrayal of a very interesting history. How the film will handle those 500-plus pages and documents, time will tell. But this is an important part of Jung's history, Jung's clinical history. The years immediately leading up to Liber Novus. And hearing that history may broaden your reading and understanding of his Red Book. Okay, quite naturally, Jung's personal relationships with women reflect in all Jung's later writings about the anima. And the anima is one of the central myths of analytic psychology, the soul, feminine gendered in the experience of a man. And Jung was a man. And I say here a myth of Jungian psychology. I don't mean myth in the sense of lie, but I mean myth as a sense of a story that's true, as something that helps us understand a fact. Okay. It's my observation that our sexuality, our relation to gender, and our experience of love play on the center stage of our experience of life, both in our outward relationships and the mystery of the deepest inner soulful longings. The word anima, as Jung eventually coined the term, was not a theory. Anima was a word pointing toward a fact of human experience. Jung met his anima, his soul, both in projective relationships with real women and very directly in his imaginative intercourse with the soul, recorded in Liber Novus. Both events, inner and outer, were accompanied by a good deal of eros. In Jung, inner and outer, facts wed. So, love. How do you talk about love? You know, here, words do not define the experience. The experience fills the words. If you had an experience of love, that's your definition. And if you haven't, well, the word stands a bit barren. You know, some people find it absolutely impossible to understand that some other people, others, have not had that experience. And yet, sometimes it's not really part of our life. It's something we ponder about and wonder if we've had. Okay? All right, so what's the vocabulary? Okay, let's use some psychological terms. Projection. What's a projection? Your turn.
The part of me I don't like.
So somewhere else. I get a part of me that I don't like that I see somewhere else. A part of me I do like that I see somewhere else. Huh?
Or don't know you have that are capable of.
Yeah. A part of me I don't know I have that I see somewhere else. You know? Those are three very good definitions in sum. Okay, first of all, does it involve only negative or positive content? No. The projections often that we become most aware of are our negative ones. You know, our angers, our intense negative feelings, because often they're that conflictual relationship, we try to analyze it, we try to look at it. Well, it's part of our positive projections too. But the positive, we tend to see just as magic. Gee, I like that person. That person is showing me something wonderful. And sometimes you see that projection as a part of ourselves that we didn't know we had. Most commonplace you meet projections? Well, it's relationship. Negative or positive relationship. And one of the places you really meet a really powerful projection, love. Right? Something deep and sacred and precious. Something that you want to be part of you, you may see outwardly. Have you ever fallen in love at first sight? The only way. You know, let me just put it this way. It's a good place to stop with love because there's no disappointment. I remember as a young man riding on the metro in Paris. And, you know, there are a lot of attractive women in the world, and in Paris particularly. And, you know, they'd pass you by. I sat down on the seat of this subway, and there was a woman sitting three chairs up that I fell in love with instantly. Why her? I mean, she wasn't the most attractive person. She was just the one. And I couldn't stare at her, so I sort of stared looking at her reflection in the window so she wouldn't really notice that I was staring at her. And I was just like, I felt all this stuff welling up. And then she gets off the subway. And I can still look in the window and see her image. I can imagine it. The projection. Okay. What was that? I didn't know projection. I don't know. But something inside of me, really inside of me, had landed on this unknown object. And I was having a relationship with it. You see, that's why I say it, that's a good place to stop, because when you really meet the real person, that's the beginning of all the problems, right? If you can just be in a relationship with the sacred image inside yourself, and that person is just that, but there's a problem. That person is real. They're a human being. And what happens? We have to withdraw the projection. Well, most of the time we don't withdraw the projection. We sort of shatter it and splatter it on the ground of the kitchen. Is that love? Did I miss something? All right. Okay. You know, it's magic. Why does one person do that to us? Why does one person bring out the negative and another person bring out the positive?
Or the same person.
Or the same person. And actually, that's really the most interesting part of it, because it is often that way. Same thing. That might require some analysis. Okay, what's a transference? You hear about transference in clinical psychology. What's a transference? Your turn.
That could be projecting onto a person some aspects of one's experience from former relationships, qualities of one's experience from another person.
Okay, you're talking. You're playing right at the around an analytic theory, which is really important. It's when we. Okay, you're off the hook. I'll just start talking. Transference in analytic parlance often refers to the relationship to the analyst, where we transfer an image, a relationship, a person onto the analyst. And what you're talking about is the classic part of psychoanalytic theory, where who do you transfer? Mama, daddy. And all of a sudden the analyst becomes the mom and daddy. And then as they bear that image, you're relating to some of that psychological material from an earlier trauma of relationship. You're projecting it onto the analyst, and the analyst is then trying to analyze the transference. Okay? Well, transference. Is it always mama or daddy? No. Brother? Sister? Don't go to that analyst, okay? Just that relationship's not going far.
But I mean, you can do that for your clients.
Yes. Right. It can be, and then, my God, you've got your hands full. You really do have your hands full, don't you? You've got an intense analytic relationship. Well, Jung said sometimes the transference can be archetypal. Now, what the hell does he mean by that? The transference can be archetypal. Huh? We're not talking just a transference of a image of or even a relationship that you've had. You might transfer. You might put, and hear the word transference and relationship and projection. You know, they're very deeply related. You might transfer onto the analyst the image of teacher, guide, shaman, healer, God. Yeah. What happens when that sort of transference occurs? Well, what happens is, holy shit, what you don't want in an analytic relationship probably is to have that happen. But it does. I mean, you don't want to go looking for that. Anyone that goes looking for that has a problem with their own psychology. And there are such people. We call them gurus, masters, teachers of, you know, in cultic situations, cultic groups, where there is a charismatic figure. Often people come to that individual because they have a transference. They see in this person a teacher, a guide. And you know some of those people? They're vampires. They take that projection and they drink its blood. Don't they? They drink its blood, they drink its money, they drink its flesh sexually, exploitively. Does that happen? You're damn right it happens. And sometimes it's a love image. Especially in a contrasexual relationship. Sometimes it's the image of the most sacred love you might ever have. And so I expect that a wise therapist making a referral of a patient would probably be extremely hesitant about referring an exotic 19-year-old woman with intense and troubling sexual complexes and deep mythical romantic inclinations to a 29-year-old doctor in the early stages of comprehending a very intense anima complex. But then in 1904, when 19-year-old Russian Sabina Spielrein arrived in Zurich and became the patient of 29-year-old Dr. C.G. Jung, 3 years out of medical school, 1 year married, there was yet no fully fleshed out, and I do mean fleshed out, understanding of an anima complex. That came years later. Many years later. In fact, Dr. Jung's experience with Sabina was one of the experiences that filled the concept of that word. Okay? So I don't have enough time to go through this. I would have liked to have gone through this in more detail because it's fun to talk about. It's sex, I mean, really. But...
You'll stay late.
You'll stay... My type of girl. My type... Hey, okay, all right. Okay, get the champagne out. Sleeping bags. You asked for it. And a cigar.
Yep. 10 minutes only.
Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, madam. Okay. All right. So, very few people knew the name of Sabina Spielrein until about 30 years ago. She existed only as an anonymous patient in case histories published by Jung, and it is a side note in some of the letters between Sigmund Freud and Jung.
So does that suggest that she was seen by both Jung and Freud?
Yep.
At the same time?
Nope.
But Freud after Jung.
Freud after Jung. And why would she go to Freud after Jung?
She had a lot to discuss.
Yep. Well, that was a question that Carl Gustav Jung was asking himself when she went to Freud on the threshold of the rupture of their relationship. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's an interesting story, guys. All right. So very few people knew this name until, amazingly, a collection of her diaries, fragments of her diaries, and her letters... and Jung's letters, intimate private letters to her, were found at the end of the 1970s and early 1980s. In brief biography, Sabina was a Russian Jew. She lived in the east and south of Russia on the Black Sea. Rostov-on-Don was the name of her home city. Her family was extremely wealthy. Her paternal ancestors had been Hasidic Rebbe, Hasidic mystical Jews. But her father and that generation had been very secular, removed from their religion, and she was absent that influence in her life. Her mother had felt, before I go there, let me also put in the last part. She went on to become an important analyst. She was a brilliant woman. Talented, insightful, troubled, and troubled by her love for Jung for all of her life. She died in 1942 in Russia. In 1924, she returned from Western Europe to her home in Russia. In 1942, she was last seen being marched away by the Nazis who had occupied her home to a ravine where they were all machine gunned. Okay. That's the end of the story. We're at the beginning. So Sabina had been raised by a mother who, for reasons that are discernible, but I won't go into them, had tried to keep her entirely isolated from any sort of sexual knowledge. That's a bit hard. I don't know how anyone does that. But Sabina was, at age 19, restricted in all of her knowledge about normal human sexual function. Her mother had even arranged that her classes at gymnasium, and she was a very intelligent student, be devoid of mention of these things. Sabina was an intensely sexual person, and devoid of a sense of how to let it out. She was hysterical. She had been spanked by her father on her bare bottom, and that had become a focus of her erotic fantasies, to the point that a threat of beating aroused sexual thoughts, masturbatory actions, hysterical actions, sticking out her tongue, screaming. She could not stand to have people look at her. She was a very disturbed 19-year-old girl when she arrived in Zurich. Her family sent her to the Berghölzli, the hospital where Jung was still at that point a resident, thinking that she could be cured, and their intention was that after she was cured, she would enter medical school in Zurich the subsequent year. Well, okay. So this young woman shows up in Zurich and is an inpatient in the Berghölzli. And you have to understand that Berghölzli was mainly an institution for psychotic patients. There weren't too many neurotics. And Sabina was not psychotic. Crazy, yes, but not that type of crazy. Jung just was able to call himself a doctor officially after he had had his dissertation published, and that had only been in 1902. The man graduated from medical school in December of the year 1900. He was not very far into his career. But he had read some things by this fellow by the name of Sigmund Freud, with whom he had no personal contact. And Freud had not written much about his method. He hadn't told people what he did or how he did it. He had talked about the amazing effects of psychoanalysis and some of his observations. But method? He didn't write about it ever, actually. Jung's supervising physician at the Berghölzli was interested in this stuff and had encouraged interest in it in his underling physicians, and Jung was one. Jung had decided that with Sabina, his really first neurotic patient, he would try analysis. But it was a formless mimesis. He was mimicking something that he didn't know how to do, but he tried it anyway. He sat in a chair behind her back and they went through stuff, and of course Freud's stuff had been, you know, his writing so far had been talking about what? Infantile sexuality? Sexual traumas? Well, that happened to be what Sabina had suffered. And their analysis, this initial talking cure, intimately entering into this discussion with this 19-year-old girl who had never had an outlet for these sorts of thoughts or comments, worked. Within 2 months of this, you know, I think Jung started this analysis in the fall of 1904. And again, look, the man's 29 years old. Sabina's 19. At the end of a few months, she was really becoming quite functional, to the point that she was able to start helping in this psychological laboratory that they had at the hospital there, in which Jung was doing his word association experiments, looking for complex formations through word associations. And that spring, she did enter the University of Zurich's medical program. Okay. Sabina fell in love with Jung. And here I am going to have to abbreviate a bit. Around 1906, Jung started developing more of a contact, at least by correspondence with Freud. 1907, they first met. During this period, Sabina had gone from being a completely dysfunctional neurotic to a very functional young medical student who still had problems. She was seeing Jung on a weekly basis for analytic sessions. And after a while, he wasn't charging anymore. They were friends. They were talking. they were talking pretty intimately. But they were talking with an interest in the underlying psychology of what was going on in their relationship, in the therapeutic relations, in the human soul, in human sexuality. Sabina was an amazing case for some of Freud's initial theories about the effects of a therapeutic relationship, an analytic relationship. But stuff started developing in this relationship with Jung. Call it a projection, call it a transference. She saw herself in a love relationship with Jung. She was deeply in love with him. But she also had a mythic image. She saw herself as a representative of the Semitic race, and Jung as a representative of the Aryan race. And she felt that in the union, in their union, there would be born a savior, and his name would be Siegfried. They both liked Wagner, Jung, and Sabina. Okay, transference? What's the countertransference? Well, simply placed, it's when the analyst starts putting their projection on the patient. And sometimes the thing they put on them is not just their child, their daughter, their wife, their father, their mother, maybe even somebody they don't like, a thing they don't like. Sometimes what they see in the countertransference is love. See, Sabina's analysis is bringing up mythic material. What she's seen about a union of Aryan and Semitic races and two opposites coming together and a child being born that will be a savior, a world savior, that in love there is death and transformation. Those are themes that are coming out in Sabina's love for Jung. And they're talking about this. This is part of the analytic relationship. This transference is being analyzed. And that is indeed what you do in a mature relationship. You don't just accept the transference and live it out. You try to understand it. Why is this stuff coming out of her? Well, it's pretty easy to understand why she's hysterical and has erotic complexes about being spanked by her daddy and all that sort of stuff. This stuff didn't fit Freud's theory. This was something beyond anything that Jung could bring down to Freud's very materialistic concepts. And Jung was falling in love, did fall in love with Sabina. Complication, Jung just got married a few years before this. Now, I have read all of the existing papers of Sabina. All the existing material has been published. I can give you the name of the book. It was put together for a journal, the Journal of Analytic Psychology in 2001, did a special series of issues trying to amass all of this stuff that had been discovered from Sabina. Because once one cache was found, two more were found. And then other stuff was found. And then permission was received to release her records from the Berg-Holsley, which were, you know, private. You couldn't get them released from the hospital unless you had family permission. A distant and only surviving relative was found. The medical records were released. All of this was published in 2003 in a book called Sabina Spielrein, Forgotten Pioneer of Psychoanalysis. I think that's the title. It's damn interesting reading. And it's even more interesting when you know what's coming. When you know what's coming. Was their relationship sexually consummated? You know, I read this material in part to start 16 years ago. And I really came to the conclusion that they did not have a sexual relationship. They had an extraordinarily intimate relationship, which may have had some fondness and sexuality in it, without intercourse. I really thought that was the case. I reread this stuff this fall, and I came to the conclusion that they probably did consummate that relationship around October of 1910. In the months just before Sabina graduated from medical school and forever left Zurich. I've read the material, I've thought about it, I've tried to understand it, I've read their letters, and I would have liked to have shared a couple of those letters with you, but I didn't tonight. You can find them. Jung was intensely dealing with this countertransference, with his love relationship with this woman, with its mythic qualities in her and the mythic qualities it was pulling out in him. Look at the Red Book. What sort of tensions were under the ground with this dude? Huh? They came flowing out pretty quickly in 1913. 3.5 years later. They were there then. And he was analyzing it. He was really trying to understand it. Was Jung a womanizer? No, I don't think so. Did he have sexual relationships with several of his patients? No. He probably did with Sabina as a young man. In 1910, Jung was 35. They had been in an intense, psychologically toned relationship for 6 years. Sabina had finished her dissertation for her doctor, and she was about to become a psychoanalyst. This was a fairly mature and considered relationship, and I think something happened there. And then she left. She went to Munich, and then you know where she went? Huh?
Oh, she went to Vienna.
Yep, she went to Vienna. That's where Freud was. And what did she have to talk about? A transference relationship. You know, she struggled with this throughout her life. That was really the end of their close relationship. For about another 2 years, there are letters from Jung to her, and the letters are addressed, "My dear." In the hierarchy of German letter writing, there are like 15 gradations of how you address people in different social situations, starting with Herr, Doctor, Professor, Freund, to "My dear." So he was writing letters to her, still addressed as "My dear" in 1920. During World War I, she lived in Geneva, and they started corresponding again around 1917. And these letters were addressed, you know, "Dear colleague," and signed very formally. But she was still trying to understand stuff, and she was writing about this stuff. And one of the moving letters Jung wrote to her during this period, he says, "The love of Jung for Spielrein had to be sublimated, or I would have gone mad." Sublimated. You know, not taken physically, not taken in this human relationship. They weren't going to get married. They weren't going to have a baby named Siegfried who was going to be a world savior. It had to be understood, sublimated, brought into a level of conscious relationship.
So, and didn't he admit that he reinterpreted Siegfried to be their collaboration, that she had influenced his ideas?
He didn't say that directly. However, in the Red Book, before that vision, that first vision I told you about, entry into the cave, when Jung was in the desert for those 25 nights, he said, I didn't know what to do except look at my dreams. Well, he had a dream. And you know what the dream was about? You read the Red Book. It was a dream about the murder of Siegfried. It was a critical threshold event in the Red Book. You can read that, and you can read all sorts of stuff into it. And there's a whole lot of archetypal material in that. But you ought to know that this figure was on the mythic stage of Jung's intense relationship with a real woman who really touched him, who really kicked a door open. Sabina was a brilliant woman. Their conversations, if you read her dissertation, I mean, she's thinking. She was an intellectual equal to Jung during this period. And when he was analyzing her and telling her what he thought, she was standing up and giving it back, her viewpoint. This was a real dialogue. Okay?
So could you sort of briefly, in like two sentences?
Two sentences? Anything? Me?
So what was Jung's relationship like with his wife?
It was a loving relationship.
It was a what?
A loving relationship. Look, there's one other woman in Jung's life that I was going to talk about tonight in my 5-hour lecture. The second part, let me just give you, can you take 10 more minutes?
No,
you're done. Janet, you're a troublemaker. You're a troublemaker. There's got to be one in the crowd. Okay. You're asking really important questions. There are three women in Jung's life that I consider critical. There was Emma, who he married in 1903. Then along came Sabina.
A year later. Just a year later. You said that.
A year later, yeah. And look, in the first year of their analysis, there were appropriate boundaries in this relationship. He was Herr Dr. Jung, and she was patient Spielrein, Fräulein Spielrein, okay? After a while, those barriers did change. They broke down. When she entered medical school, when she was better, the relationship progressed. There was a relationship with Emma, and Emma knew that women were falling in love with her husband, Carl, pretty frequently. It was difficult for her. But she stuck with the guy. She loved him, and he loved her throughout all of this. He
never... How many children?
Five.
Okay.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The third one?
Children?
Tony, like...
Oh, the third woman.
Sometimes living with two women at once.
Yeah, Tony. Okay, and now we're getting to the juicy part. It's Jung in love. Love is messy. Love is messy. I mean, I can be really orderly about a whole lot of this stuff, but when we get to love, there aren't any rules. So the relationship really comes to a culmination and a conclusion and a termination with Sabina in the year 1910 at the end. And you know who shows up about that time? A very intelligent woman by the name of Antonia Wolf. Tony Wolf. Tony is 21 when she comes in to meet Jung. Jung at this point is 13 years her senior. Okay? And Jung is at this time working on mythology. He's trying to understand the mythological basis of some of our intra-psychic material. Oh, and what might have been a stimulation to his interest in myths like the Siegfried myth? What might have been a stimulation to that? Oh, I don't know. Something happened. Many things happened, actually, but that one thing we did mention. All right. And Toni is, she comes from a very well-to-do Zurich family, a patrician family. Her father had spent 20 years in the Orient. He was an importer of rare silks. They lived in a rather exotically fashioned or furnished home. Tony shows up, and she's extremely depressed. Her father had died suddenly. She was very close to her father. She had had a disappointment in a love relationship. She was 21 years old. She wanted to get a university degree. This is another extraordinary woman with a brilliant mind. And look, I keep saying extraordinary women. There were a lot of extraordinary women in Jung's world. It seems to me that women get Jung better than most guys, period. And that was his experience throughout his life. I don't know why, but there seems to be a sensitivity and an openness. And Toni was extraordinarily depressed. Her mother brought her to Jung for therapy in 1910. Jung was having a really hard time getting through to her. Her depression would not lift. Finally, he had been reading mythology now. Finally, he compared her depressional situation to the situation in some Greek myths. And she immediately lightened up. It so happens that she knew a lot more about these particular myths than did Jung. And she basically simply retold him the myths in much greater detail. And this was exactly what Jung was interested in. Their dialogue increased. She started helping him by going to the library, helping him with his research on what became Symbols of Transformation, the book he published that fractured his relationship with Jung, with Freud in 1912. They became friends. Friends. And in 1912 and 1913, the winter of 12 and 13, and now we're talking 10 months, 11 months before the material in the Red Book breaks open, before that first vision where he calls out, my soul, where are you? He has a dream about a dove. You'll read this in Memories, Dreams, Reflection. The dove comes, changes into a young girl. You can read the vision. In that period, and indeed in that dream, he felt there was something which gave him permission to open a love relationship with Tony. And he did. Jung burned all of his letters. All his letters to Tony and all of Tony's letters to him. We don't have any of that sort of material on this relationship. Tony died in 1953 at the age of 64, suddenly, unexpectedly. It was the custom of a family to give one's letters back to the author at the time of a person's death. Swiss ideas of privacy. Jung sat one night after her death and burned them. His to her, hers to him. We don't know the details of this relationship. If you want to know the details, well, if you hear the details, actually, recounted by others, it's hearsay on hearsay on hearsay. But hear me say this, they were in love. Jung commented in his life that he could not have made it through this visionary period without her support. He did not leave Emma during this period. Hearsay suggests that Emma was thinking about leaving Jung. But individuals who did know the people, both people well, indicated the degree of privacy they kept to their private affairs. What was going on in this magic circle of Jung and Tony and Emma was a matter of gossip, but not of direct conversation from the parties involved. Emma commented to Barbara Hanna in late life that she was grateful to Tony for what she had done, because she did not feel that her husband, whom she loved, Carl, would have survived his encounter with the unconscious, would have endured without her help. What that help consisted of? Well, it was love and it was support. In later years, she ended up being a good analyst. I could say a whole lot more about this, and I probably will in the next weeks. I'm embarrassed to have said so little about this relationship. You hear nothing about the relationship of Tony Wolf and C.G. Jung in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. Why? Well, actually, there was. There was Jung. And it was edited out by request of his family, his children. This was an atypical relationship. Jung essentially had two love relationships. Tony and Emma went together to the psychological club in the 1920s, and they sat on both sides of Jung. They went socially as a pair, as a threesome. Very often. Jung spent a night a week at her house, and everyone knew because his car was parked right there for everyone to see. People knew this was going on. It was an interesting situation. They came to an accord. That's all I can say right now. I'll stop there. With one addition. From the Red Book, you will read these words. In the late Red Book, Jung's talking about his situation. He's speaking to his soul. Jung is dealing with love to the depths. And his soul says to him, and I speak now, the soul, "You express yourself emotionally and philosophically. You know that one can say all this much more simply. For example, one can say that you have fallen in love from the worm up to Tristan and Isolde." From the worm up to Tristan and Isolde. From the phallic issues, the phonic flesh of the worm, up to Tristan and Isolde, the transcendental love relationship on the crystalline bed. Okay? All right. And Jung replies, "Yes, I know, but nonetheless." And then his soul says, "Religion is still tormenting you, it seems. How many shields do you need? Much better, say it out straight." Jung replies, "You're not tripping me up. his soul says to him. Well, what is it with morality? Have morality and immorality become one today? Jung replies, you're mocking me, my sister and thonic devil. But I must say that those two that rose up to heaven entwined are also good and evil. I'm not joking, but I groan. Freudian slip. But I groan because joy and pain sound shrill together. So in summary, Jung had an intense relationship to the feminine mystery in the years from 1903 to 1913. But it was a chaos of extreme and extremely intimate sexual facts, psychological theorems, emotions, and conflicts. He married Emma in February 1903. He met Spielrein in 1904 and Tony Wolfe in 1910. All three relationships were intense and different. The relationships with these three real women left him puzzling about a power he had experienced in himself, experienced in and through the woman, and relationship with her. In Liber Novus, Jung's meeting with the mystery of the feminine is an interior mystery. First as a child he met her, then as Salome, as soul, serpent, and dove. But he came to this experience with questions formed from life experience over the prior years. In Liber Novus, his conversation is turned to the interior source of a conundrum of life, probing the depths, seeking a source of understanding, understanding his experience within his own story, his own myth. The noumen and daimon of sexuality has an interior psychic and an exterior human reality. Life facts intermingle in this developing relationship to the feminine fact of his soul. This raw history is working in the dialogues of Liber Novus. Outer life is touching a mythical inner life. Man lives in two worlds. And these worlds had already touched in real women. Women whom he had touched and who had touched him. The mystery of love, of a man and a woman, of flesh and spirit, of inner and outer realities. These all play a part in Liber Novus. Thank you.